Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. Joining us today is Emily Drabinsky, the interim chief librarian and the critical pedagogy librarian of the Minor East Library at the CUNY Graduate Center. She is also a part-time faculty member at the Pratt Institute School of Information. She formerly held the position of coordinator of library instruction at Long Island University, Brooklyn, where she worked from 2008 to 2019. She was a 2014 Library Journal Mover and Shaker Advocate and winner of the Eileen F. Rockman Instruction Publication of the Year in 2015 for her article, Towards a Kairos of Library Instruction. Emily is a leading scholar of librarianship. The Kairos of Library Instruction article and her 2013 Queering the Catalog are canonical texts in the library and information sciences curriculum. Drabinsky co-edited the 2009 Critical Library Instruction, Theories and Methods, and she edits the Library Juice Press series on gender and sexuality in library and information services. Drabinsky co-edited a 2019 Library Trends issue, Labor in Academic Libraries. Emily is a candidate for the 2023-2024 presidency of the American Library Association. The association is the foremost national organization providing resources to inspire library and information professionals to transform their communities through essential programs and services for more than 140 years. She has been active in the ALA over many years, having served as the chair of the International Relations Committee, as the counselor at large and chair of the Association of College and Research Libraries, Information Literacy Frameworks and Standards Committee, and she is running against Kelvin Watson. Balloting begins on March 14th and runs through April 6th. Welcome back to The Thought Project, Emily Drabinsky.
Thank you so much, Tanya. It's exciting to be here.
This is great. Just for our audience information, this is the first time The Thought Project has returned to the studio at CUNY TV. We are so happy to be back. Emily, you became the interim chief librarian at the Graduate Center on March 16th, 2020. It must have been bittersweet. And what was the first thing on your mind that day?
You know, I knew I was going to take over this role from Polly Thistlewaite, who headed over to Central. And I was on a last hurrah visiting my family who had gone to the Philippines. My partner had a Fulbright scholarship and ended up in Manila and was scheduled to be there for 5 months. And the pandemic hit and I kind of didn't believe it. I kept sort of changing my transfer airport so I wouldn't get blocked coming back to the country. And it felt sort of like I was in an action movie, rolling under the door, the garage door as it closed and then came back to the GC. The first thing on my mind was making sure people had what they needed to be able to continue to do their jobs, you know, and that we could all survive.
Absolutely. Survival of the fittest. But this kind of event for graduate students, particularly PhD students, is devastating.
Absolutely devastating.
Right? Because it rules out the whole idea of field research. And therefore, the library becomes a prominent fixture in your mind and in your daily life. And I know
to the credit of Polly, I was, you know, working with Polly for several years and knowing that she did so much to build up the digital reserves of the library and was always talking about open access. And so you walked in with a floor under your feet.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely. Yes. You know, this is a library that thinks of itself as a network, as part of a network, and that was a real focus of Polly's work. And
yeah, her collaboration with NYPL.
With NYPL, yes. With all of the libraries in the Metro system, with OCLC shares, and these are things that if you're a librarian listening, you're nodding along, and the rest of you are like, wait, what? I just wanted to get my book. But
yeah,
those infrastructures of sharing are so crucial to what we do, and so much work was put into that. So we started from a pretty good place. But there is, especially for humanities students and for historians who need to do archival research,
right,
there's no substitute for being able to come into the library. And that was something that we couldn't provide for a very long time.
For sure. Absolutely. So what did you do during the pandemic? I mean, you and your staff returned to the library, and I don't remember at what point was that?
So we reopened for students in June 2021, after being closed for more than a year. And it was tough. We had vaccines at that point. And so, you know,
right,
those of us who'd been vaccinated, I think, felt a little easier about it. But it was stressful and difficult and hard and scary. And how do we gather again? You know, this is March 2022, and it's the first time you've been back in the studio. Like, how do we walk back towards being together? So we opened in June and saw students come in. We had a reservation system. You had to reserve a spot. We kept the numbers really low to keep density down.
Right.
And every student we saw was sort of made my heart swell 18 sizes. You know, we learned both that the library is crucial for research, but it's also crucial just to like leave your apartment and get some quiet from your kids and roommates and, you know, be able to sit and do work in quiet space in Midtown Manhattan. And we are now essentially open as we always have been, evenings and weekends, and we've got a full slate of in-person services.
Yeah, that was a hard fought for and very challenging time, because you and your staff were the first people providing services to students that returned to the building.
Mm-hmm.
That was before all of us returned in August.
Yes.
And so you guys broke the ground on return.
We did. I was eager to do it, to be honest. I am someone who did not thrive at home at all, who really needs to leave and then go back again to feel good.
Sure.
So it was something that we all worked really hard on. And, you know, to see how crucial you are to the intellectual life of the city and to the Graduate Center and to CUNY, you know, I take that really seriously. I think all of us do.
That's wonderful. And so this week we returned to the building for 70% of staff, and it's really great. I've seen several people, including you, Emily.
How have you been? We made it.
And Kevin Wolf, my audio engineer, and here at CUNY TV, and Lisa, who also works in the radio team. I have to say that this is really wonderful, right?
Listen, there's no substitute for public life. There's no substitute for contact, I don't think. And to the extent that it's safe to do so, I'm so pleased to be back.
And kudos to our librarian staff and all that you all did for the Graduate Center and for the students.
I have to shout out my colleague, Curtis Matthew, who
has
done just incredible work getting our circulation system back up and running and staffing the service point so that we're able to invite students back for evening and weekend service. He's been a rock.
The person who's initiated that.
He's an exceptional leader, and I'm so grateful to have had him
I know Curtis. I know Curtis. Yes, he's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. So let me just also ask you another question about the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Did it compel you to rethink librarianship? I mean, if it did, I mean, did you begin to think about, okay, so here we are, we're in this pandemic, we don't really know how long it's going to last.
Mm-hmm.
Did it give you an opportunity to think about librarianship and maybe how it should be tweaked, or also possibilities for after the pandemic as well?
It's an interesting question. So, you know, librarians are actually at the forefront of a lot of technological change, right? We're among the first to adopt new computing technologies,
yes,
and we're really quite innovative.
Yes.
If the pandemic taught me anything, though, if it did anything, it made me sort of more of a traditionalist. What I saw people wanting from the library were things that the library has always sort of been a space for, connecting you to the resources you need to do your research project, giving you access to a bathroom and a well-lit, heated or cooled space, although I have my complaints about HVAC. My office is very chilly in the winter. But that aside, you know, the library is a space where you can go that is non-commercial and that is freely available to you if you're a member,
right,
of the community. That is something that I don't know that it was forgotten, but I've been in so many contexts where people have said, oh, the library is a portal, the internet changes everything. Why do we need a library anymore? Because you can just go to the internet. But I think we all learned the limits of that,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Yes.
It actually isn't enough. You know, you need to be able to leave where you are and go somewhere else and be in communion with others who are engaged in intellectual pursuits. And I think I have a new found, interest in creating those kinds of experiences for myself and for others in the library.
Yeah, fair enough, too. And, you know, you have to lay your hands on a book.
Oh, you have to lay your hands on a book. You,
right,
do.
Yeah,
you have to walk to the shelf to get the book that you looked up and then be like, oh, this other book over here actually looks relevant also. And you pull it off the shelf and you look at it.
Exactly.
There's just no substitute for that. And it's not nostalgia for me. It's like that's actually the material practice of knowledge production, you know, walking around the library and picking out some books.
It's absolutely.
Like, that's what it's about.
Absolutely. Know? So before we get to the big conversation,
yeah,
between us about your candidacy for the American Library Association presidency, I want to ask you, you have done a couple of podcasts. We're living in this era in America, in this moment in America, and I think it harkens back to the McCarthy era,
mm-hmm,
in some different ways. But can we talk about the banning of books?
Mm-hmm.
And book lists and,
mm-hmm,
banning of books in schools and in public libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be surprised before this is all over that we're going to see burning of books.
Oh, yeah. I think you have seen that.
What are your thoughts on this? I mean, I know you have strong thoughts on it, but let's start about the banning of books and the intervention of quote-unquote parents trying to protect their children from critical race theory.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not about books, you know? It's like the fight against gay marriage was not about, like, not wanting gay people to get married.
Absolutely.
It's about not wanting gay people at all.
That's
so
right.
You ban books about LGBTQ experience, or you ban books about Black experience, books about the Holocaust. You ban these books not because,
right,
you don't want people to read them, but because you don't want Black people, Jewish people, gay people to exist at all. So it's very scary and very violent and super organized. And I think that's the thing that's most frightening to me, you know?
Yes.
That these are not,
yes,
one-off individual parents saying, oh, my child is,
right,
precious.
This is,
right,
being initiated by governors and,
oh, yeah,
legislators and mayors and it's like we've let loose a burning fire that's just consuming people.
The right is highly organized and really well-resourced. There's a great book by Jen Schrady called The Revolution That Wasn't. She talks about the influence of the internet on organizing and makes the case that I find compelling and true that the far right simply has access to more money and time. And there's a reason that their websites are sort of prettier than a union website, right? Because they just have more money and more
resources
to pour into,
right,
that. And they're better at organizing people around a sort of disciplined party line where we're against all kinds of difference. You know, we want a white Christian nation and we're going to take steps everywhere we can to make that happen. And they also know that people feel good when they can experience power in a collective act.
Right.
So they produce ways into those feelings of sort of solidarity that we sort of work for on the left as well. But, you know, I can, with another two or three angry white mob parents, organized to get a book off a library shelf and succeed and get a feeling of real capacity and power to change the world. So I think the right is just really better at doing that right now because they have more resources, and the party discipline is really, you know, for somebody on the left, it's like it's sort of impressive to see.
Sure. You know? And also what drives their organizing is just this sheer rage.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you don't have that on the, you know, Democratic left, you know, rage. Yes, we are angry about losing our voting rights and we're angry about those things. But the rage that is coming out of these people is just, that to me is very threatening. Like, because from that rage comes violence and acts
Absolutely.
Of violence, banning these books and removing mm-hmm. books. You know, it's very interesting what you say. You're talking about erasing the Holocaust, erasing the history of slavery in America, mm-hmm. and the fact that the parents want to protect their children from feeling bad about the history of the country. And what I find so interesting is Heath Brown, one of our faculty members, who's John Jay and here at the Graduate Center, wrote a book called Homeschooling the Right. Mm. And he was just in an Atlantic Magazine piece called Red Parent, Blue Parent, talking about these issues,
okay,
about
I'll have
the books.
Pick that up.
Yes, mm-hmm. you have to pick it up. His book is great. And he says, you know, the biggest success that the right claims, and you don't see them talking about it publicly, is homeschooling.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And they give them credit when they're at these meetings or conventions. Mm-hmm. They always give big props to homeschoolers. And, you know, that's where you create citizenship. That's where you create citizens.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, public education is also one of the sort of public investments we make on behalf, like our share of the social wage that goes to public institutions,
right?
Like schools, roads, parks, hospitals,
right.
Libraries,
right?
Libraries, and the sort of, you know, so it's about book banning and it's about hate and it's about fear, but it's also about not wanting a robust public sector, so that
that's the, right,
you know, and that.
So that something can be challenged, that there would be a discourse that would challenge, there would be debates.
Yeah, but they don't even want schools or libraries at all, right?
That's right.
They want all of it to be privatized and profit-driven.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's like, it's tough, right? And so where are the librarians on that, you know, pretty strongly against sort of these abrogations of our professional expertise to select materials for our communities? Like, that's our core
job.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you
right.
pay me to do here, is to pick resources and curate them for the community mm-hmm. that I serve.
But haven't librarians always been at the vanguard of freedom, more or less, protecting people's
I mean, I think in some
personal mm-hmm. information from the government? Your community's pretty cool.
I think our community is pretty cool, but, you know, American libraries are like any other American institution. It's
true.
Rooted in racial exclusion.
True.
And, you know, black people not, you know, being banned
true.
From libraries in the South. That's a part of our heritage,
sure,
too.
Sure, of course.
But our, you know, our commitment to the right to read what you want to read is also fairly core
right.
commitment for almost everyone I know in the field.
Right.
So,
right.
And that cuts across party lines, you know. And so one of the things the right has done is make the selection of books a political question.
Right.
When, you know, it's a professional question. I get to sort of make the decisions about how we're going to spend our resources in terms of the materials
and
we
what
collect.
You're going to purchase.
Yeah, and that's my job. And, you know, sort of Jennison Lucas is the current president of the Association of Library Services to Children, and her position on this is, I think, one of the clearest I've seen, that it, by politicizing what we do as professionals,
you compromise.
Yeah, these activists are taking away our sort of professional field of, you know, terrain of struggle, and it's not, yeah, it's something we're all fighting against, I think.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I wanted to get that out on the table.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like the thing that's happening right now. And I haven't seen it roll up to, like, this, you know, the CUNY system, but I'm sure there are academic libraries facing similar battles in other parts of the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I have friends on Vanderbilt faculty, and they're surrounded. You know, mm-hmm. Nashville is where this all went down on Mouse.
Of course.
On Mouse, the book Mouse, a graphic novel about the history of the Holocaust. And God, we wouldn't want our children to know about that, or we wouldn't want them to feel bad about that. Well, we have more anti-Semitic attacks now in New York than any other minority group. It's the number one hate crimes are carried out, and this includes graffiti in the NYPD database. And then the second most is LGBT, and the third most is Muslim in New York City. And so this is a terrible time to say, let's get rid of Mouse.
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to go home after work to my Jewish girlfriend and our Jewish son, and, you know, we're going to have dinner and fight about homework, and it's hard to live inside of that and what's to hate about that, but
absolutely.
A lot, apparently. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yes, this is a tenuous time. It's a frightening time. And, you know, librarianship is, I follow them. And as I told you as we were walking down here, that you and I are both alumna of Columbia. There's 27 libraries at Columbia, and I'm just always wowed. I mean, wowed by it. It's like I call it one of the jewels in the crown. Sorry, CUNY. I have to say something about it. I was there on the weekend. I also want to say at the time, we're talking about Russia right now and the Balkans, and the Columbia Libraries have 80,000 texts from former Yugoslavia, the largest collection outside of the region.
Wow.
So I'm just like wowed by librarians. And as a scholar myself, and here we are at the CUNY Graduate Center, PhD education, graduate education, you cannot underestimate just how important really well-educated scholarly librarians are in our research, ongoing research. I was just there this weekend, and I was talking to this librarian. I said, are you a student? You can't tell now, you know. She said, I'm staff. I said, oh, we love you. We love you. So love to the librarians. And now we want to talk to you, Emily, about your candidacy for the American Library Association 23-24, you're running against Kelvin Watson. Sorry, Kelvin, it's right in front of me. Balloting begins on March 14th and it runs through April 6th. You have a website. You've done so many podcasts. You're running a very, very well-organized campaign. I can say that as a former Politico. I used to work in politics. Message is everything. What is your message? Why are you running?
You're asking me that on a day when I'm asking myself that. So it'll take me
Well, if you aren't asking yourself, then you shouldn't be running.
You know, I think the pandemic has shown all of us that the world could be different. We know that the world could be different than it is because it was different than it has ever been before. And we're all sort of encountering it, you know, here at CUNY this week, right? So it's a time of incredible devastation, but I think also a time of incredible opportunity if we can sort of jump in this moment where workers especially are seeing their power and seeing how crucial it is that we be organized against capital in order to keep our institutions going, right? I think now is the moment for a left progressive vision to take hold among workers at all levels. And I think we see that in union campaigns at Starbucks. We see it happening in
Amazon
warehouses. We see organizing in the South that's really sort of knocking my socks off. And, you know, library workers have been at the front lines of this pandemic. They are the people who
essential workers.
Yeah, they've been asked to do all kinds of things that are beyond the purview of the library, sending out COVID tests, like being the site for, you know, where you get Narcan, like as the last funded public good in most places. The library is the only place you can go to stop in and check your email, go to the bathroom, get a book, meet a friend without having to pay an admission fee and without
No commercial transaction.
Yeah, without having to be advertised to. And so we need those spaces to be fully funded. We need other public goods to be and institutions to be fully funded so the library can do what it's meant to do. I'm a librarian, but I've also spent a lot of time doing union work. I've been on strike. Mm-hmm. I've been locked out. All of those experiences tell me that if we can organize collective power in this moment where power seems to be on the ground, and if you can pick it up, you can have it, you know, in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I think as a collective, there are 46,000. I just got the member list. There are 46,000 members of the American Library Association. That's probably a fraction of the mm-hmm. total number of people working in libraries. But if we could organize that sector around the kinds of priorities that you and I have been talking about here, the right to read and
right.
that sort of thing, everything in the world would be better. So, yeah, I think I'm somebody who can do that. So I'm running.
So you've been really involved in the ALA. I want our audience to know that actually the ALA is, according to them, is the foremost national organization providing resources to inspire library and information professionals to transform their communities through essential programs and services for more than 140 years. Mm-hmm. Didn't you say it's the fifth largest trade organization, trade association mm-hmm. in the United States?
That's right.
Oh, that's amazing. You have served as the ALA chair of the International Relations Committee. You were also counselor at large and chair of the Association of College and Research Libraries, Information Literacy Frameworks and Standards Committee. You've got quite a CV for this position.
Thank you for saying that.
That's pretty august credentials there. So what kind of feedback are you getting? Because I understand you've been calling people and talking to people and you're doing these podcasts. Mm-hmm. You're interacting with the members. What are you hearing from them?
People are worried and scared. They're tired. They're angry. They are looking for ways to feel less alone in their work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm describing myself in many ways.
Sure,
also,
sure,
you know,
sure.
We've come out of 2 years of isolation and intense demands on our resources and services. And yeah, I think people are excited for hopeful messages that are about coming together and making change and sort of wrenching from the players that we were talking about earlier who want to privatize everything, including the air, sort of wrench some of that back for public use, the ways that we do that here at CUNY and the ways that we do that in public libraries. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are excited about the campaign.
Cool.
Unless they're voting for Kelvin, they're a little less excited.
Well, we'll drop the link into your website to give everybody into the podcast narrative. We'll give everybody an opportunity to take a look at what you have to say. What do you do for fun? I know you're a cat person because I'm a cat mm-hmm. person and I always see your photos on Twitter. What mm-hmm. do you do for fun?
I have cats. this will surprise you. I'm a reader.
Really?
I read a lot. I'm in this reading group, this reading challenge group organized by the labor historian Julie Green, whose book on the Panama Canal is a must read.
Okay.
And we have 50 categories of books, and we have to read a book in each category. So I'm reading like a book a week. And the other thing that It's rigorous, and it's really fun. I'm reading so many more works in translation than I ever had before. And it really is true. A book can take you to another world. The other thing I'm doing a lot for fun, and I don't want to leave this out of the podcast.
Yes.
I am training for a springtime show with my adult onset synchronized swimming squad.
Oh, my God.
So that's on Saturdays.
I know. That's rigorous, too.
Extremely rigorous. We have to build the entire routine around the fact that I can't do a backwards somersault underwater, but that's okay.
Okay, so which pool do you work out at?
We're at the Berkeley Carroll pool on Saturdays practicing our routines. So I'll make sure that you know what the date of
the
big show.
Okay, so I am wowed because I know that is really rigorous. I am a lap swimmer.
You're a lap swimmer?
Yes, I am.
So you know what I'm talking
about. Yes, I do know what you're talking about. That's mm-hmm. like core strength.
Yeah.
That's like you rock.
So it's me and one heavily pregnant member, and we're having to sort of build a routine around our our attendant challenges. But, you know, it takes everybody to get in the pool. So
Wow. Okay. Is there anything else that you want to ask, or is there any other comment that you want to make before we say goodbye?
I don't know. It's an exciting moment, I think. And it's so nice to see you, and it's so nice to talk with you.
Absolutely.
And the return to public life,
yes,
that we're seeing in New York City
is wonderful.
That's wonderful, and that's what we need to be doing. We need to be spending more time with one another. And
okay,
I'm
Emily,
grateful to spend it with you.
Thank you. After you win, mm-hmm. we will have you back.
That's
to
gonna
the
be
Thought
exciting.
Project.
Yes.
We will have you back. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Tanya. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project, and thanks to our guest, Emily Drabinsky, the interim chief librarian at the CUNY Graduate Center. The Thought Project is brought to you with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Kevin Wolf of CUNY TV. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.